Black Talk Radio Network is made possible in part with help from the Black Talk Media Project, a North Carolina-based nonprofit engaged in the production and distribution of independent digital black media. Find out more by going to blacktalkradionetwork.com or blacktalkmediaproject.org and look for the menu tab, Crowdfunding Black Media. Black Talk Media Project, helping to provide you with new black media for the new millennium. And opinions expressed by callers, guests, and hosts do not necessarily reflect those of the Black Talk Radio Network and Black Talk Media Project. Black Talk Radio is new black media for the new millennium.
This is Onaje Moweed. I am the host of Race Treaty that comes to you every Friday evening between 9 and 10, and sometimes even 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And what we do here on Race Treaty is to connect our people's lived experience to the human rights movement, particularly looking at ICERD, International Convention to Eliminate Discrimination. Of course, we move further to talk about to eliminate racism as a worldwide system of domination that all people of color are suffering under, as well as those who consider themselves white as well, not understanding the absence of justice anywhere is the absence of justice everywhere. And the absence of peace anywhere is the absence of peace anywhere. So tonight's program is entitled The Week After and the Day After. And I'm referring to the week after May 19th and the day after May 25th. May is the month that holds the birthday of Malcolm X, El-Haj Malik El-Shabazz Omawali. That is May 19th. So therefore, we name the show 1 week after. And also, African Liberation Day is celebrated internationally May 25th. Thus, we have the title, The Day After. African Liberation Day was founded in 1958 when Kwame Nkrumah convened the first Conference of Independent States held in Accra, Ghana, and attended by 8 independent African states. Then the 15th of April was declared African Freedom Day to be marked each year. However, on May 25th, 1963, 31 African heads of states convened a summit meeting to found the Organization of African Unity. They renamed African Freedom Day African Liberation Day and changed its date to May 25th. And it's celebrated still today, not as popular as it was particularly in the 60s and the 70s and maybe the 80s, but it's still a major event nonetheless and still is occurring. Today we have two guests. Tonight we have two guests that will speak to their involvement with both agendas, that is the influence of Malcolm X on their life, and their involvement in African Liberation Day. And thirdly, what are they doing to continue those movements, those missions, their associated goals and objectives. So I am pleased to have with us tonight two extraordinary men who have made a tremendous difference in so many arenas. The first is Dr. Fareed Muhammad. Fareed I. Muhammad. Dr. Muhammad has served as member of the faculty administration at East West Western University since 1980, served as a former chairman of the Division of Liberal Arts and Sciences and director of Department of Behavior Sciences until his formal retirement January 2014. His graduate training covers the fields of clinical psychology, international studies, and human rights policy, with a final concentration in higher education administration and management. He earned his BA in psychology from Iona College in New Rochelle, New York, his master's in arts in clinical psychology from Bradley University, and performed doctorate studies in the New School of Social Research, State University of New York, Indiana University of Bloomington, and completed his doctorate in education at University of Sarasota in Florida. His faculty appointments are numerous. He has not only worked in the public domain, but also in religious venues. He served as the Dean of Minister of Education for Muhammad University of Islam, and currently serves as the Secretary General of the Board of Trustees for American Islamic College. You know, notwithstanding his illustrious education career, Dr. Muhammad is a founding member of the Directorate, if I'm saying it right, of the International Human Rights Association of American Minorities, otherwise known as ICRAM, an NGO in consultative status with the United Nations. He held a 41-member international ICRAM delegation to the historic United Nations World Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa in 2001. We are thrilled to have him with us, this world traveler who's been in Africa, been in Europe, it's been in Canada, Caribbean. I don't think there's too many countries he hasn't visited. He has an adult children and lives with his wife in Chicago, and enjoys traveling, arts, and teaching in various sports, especially now that he's retired. Dr. Muhammad, welcome.
Oh, my pleasure, brother.
So there's two questions, actually three. One is your involvement with the influence that Malcolm X has had on your life and your work. And the second is your involvement with African Liberation Day. And the third question is, how is that influencing the works that you are currently involved with? Please do share.
Well, thank you so very much for the opportunity, and Ramadan Mubarak to you, brother. By the way, in terms of sort of trying to find some common linkage among the various themes that you, were kind enough to draw our attention to, I think it's probably proper to at least address some of the origin and history behind the African Liberation Day movement, going all the way back to the late 1950s, 1958, if I'm not mistaken, then led and spearheaded by Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, which, as you might recall, convened the first conference of independent states, which was held in Accra, Ghana, the first liberated and independent African nation. So within that context, things sort of transpired and mutated accordingly, and this was in a post-World War II mode. The decolonization movement, the following the Bandung Conference and so forth, contributed, and there was many obviously historic and momentous changes that were taking place throughout the developing world at the time, as I'm sure you can appreciate. If I'm not mistaken, in the early 60s, I believe it was in 1963 or thereabouts, in May, about 30-some-odd African heads of state convened to form what was then known as the Organization of African Unity. And it was in that context, once again, going back to the leadership of Kwame Nkrumah back in the 50s, that the concept of African Liberation Day and sort of an attempt to systematize, to create the infrastructure, to at least draw some common attention and interest to the needs of the developing African nations in particular, on the continent, and that was traditionally celebrated and convened in May of each successive year. This then sort of led to, I think, one of the most, as far as my personal metamorphosis, so to speak, was concerned. There were several writings or publications that sort of caught the time that I was going through my little growth and transformation there in Harlem, New York, which is where I'm originally from. And while I was at the State University of New York at Albany doing some graduate studies, and at that time in the late 60s, subsequent to the assassination of both Dr. King and Brother Malcolm, the writings of Osachi Fobe that had particular impact upon me and many, many other brothers and sisters at the time was the writings of Kwame Nkrumah called Conscientiousness. And that was a very unique publication. It's a very small book, but extremely, extremely powerful, and probably still to today has tremendous relevance for helping us come up with a template by which we can conceptually, you know, sort of analyze and look at all of the historical and social and cultural contradictions that exist in the content and the context of Africa, as well as other parts of the nations of the South. And he sort of identified three major dynamics or three major themes that had to ultimately be reconciled before we could eventually move to the aspirational goal of United Africa. And they were identifying and looking at the historical and cultural nuances of the animistic or the traditional traditions in Africa, the Christian influences and the Islamic influences, and began to sort of draw a template, which he almost treated in a mathematical kind of way in terms of coming up with a series of suggested syllogisms and logical analysis, et cetera, by which the leadership in Africa could begin to systematically identify and address some common concerns. But as we well know, unfortunately, a lot of that momentum was still born by the subsequent coup that took place and the eventual death of so many of the historic leaders who were sort of galvanizing the movement at that time. So I think within that context, the African Liberation Day celebration, which we always celebrate even in contemporary times, has that foundational framework going back to the late 50s, 60s, all the way up to the present day. So as you know, in speaking to your particular issue or the topic that you just addressed, eventually I believe it was in the 1970s that we begin to see some additional changes that took place. And the African movement in the 1970s took on another type of growth. And the Secretariat in Ghana, in Guyana rather, in South America, began to see the relevance of the spread of this revolutionary fervor, not only in the continent of Africa and the Far East, but also here in the Western Hemisphere. And I believe this took place in the early or mid-1970s and was spearheaded by the Secretariat in the South American country of Guyana. And that sort of leads us into contemporary times where we know that in various parts of the United States and throughout the African diaspora, that African Liberation Day is typically celebrated and lessons are learned from the past and also from the present in helping us strategize how we move forward. I noticed that also there have been some contemporary activities that typically take place. There's some here in Chicago. There have been some, if I'm not mistaken, by the Community Aid Development Corporation in Atlanta, Georgia, which just recently had a series of celebratory activity in Atlanta, I think in the over the May 20th and 21st of this month. And this typically takes place in other communities as well. And Malcolm X Day celebration is also just a logical, historical, and social extension of that movement. At least that's my humble assessment.
That was quite a review, a summative review of these two particular items on the agenda and how they influenced social movements. Thank you so much for that. It was quite informative and indeed central to our talking today. So, Brother Muhammad, do share with us, when you were exposed to these writings and to these movements, how did it shape you as a human rights activist that you are?
Well, as I sort of implied, I guess, you know, at the time in the East Coast, perhaps I don't want to sort of show a cultural bias that I might have being a native New Yorker and a transplant here to Chicago, but the East and the East Coast and always seemed to be, especially in Harlem, New York. And I was at that particular time, I had just returned from Bradley University in Peoria, which is a very small Midwestern. It was a typical American city, so to speak. I think at that time, Peoria, Illinois, was considered by, you know, in sociological context, like the typical American city because of its demographic characteristics. You know, I then returned to New York and then went upstate to the State University of New York at Albany, where it was quite interesting. I don't want to go too much off target, but, you know, that was a very unique environment. This was just before the assassination of Dr. King. And here you had a major premier state institution, which I still love and have relationships with up until today, where you had over 15,000 students, a state university where 80% of the students who attended the institution came from the various public school sectors, the graduates who came out of New York City, Syracuse, Buffalo, and all the major urban centers. But yet when you got to the campus, there was less than a dozen of us on campus of African-American descent, students of African-American or Latino descent on a campus that was, you know, sort of the acme of higher education and had 80% of its population coming from the major urban centers in the United States. So that didn't quite, you know, look proper. And subsequent to King's assassination, it was a group of us, a small handful of us on campus that drew, you know, we used to have little study groups and we networked with brothers at Union College, Colgate, the Cornell University, et cetera, and that was sort of my particular sojourn into the so-called movement at the time. And we had, you know, little study groups and being students ourselves, we tried to at least not only emotionally respond to the, you know, to the demands of the time, but also to try to intellectually create some kind of conceptual and moral and religious framework upon which we saw the movement could be progress forward. And in that context, we sort of had a series of readings that we addressed and we tried to consider to help inform us as we try to strategize on how we could plow ahead and make, you know, some modest contribution, particularly in the context of being in an academic environment that was struggling and transformative at the time. And so that led to my engagement along with some other brothers and sisters from a network of colleges and universities throughout what we call the Black Student Union Associations at the time. And that was sort of my transformation into that. I had the blessed opportunity to travel throughout East Africa in the late 1970s. And subsequent to my return from the University of Makerere University in Uganda, the University of Dar es Salaam in Tanzania, and the University of Nairobi, I came back and my personal movement and sort of evolution, so to speak, led me to embrace and move into the activity that was engaged in, the Nation of Islam was engaged in at that time. I still have very cordial and extensive relationships throughout those communities and various sectors of other sectors of the African-American community, the immigrant and the general mainstream Islamic community as well. And so there are some common denominators. I think any and all peoples who strive for justice and equality and freedom and see that ultimately, unlike a lot of other social movements, if I can be presumptuous and just framing my own point of view, is to see the need to always maintain some type of I guess because I'm somewhat of an idealist of sorts, a moral imperative and a social imperative that ultimately, without some type of a spiritual or moral focus, that could at least serve as a kind of a fulcrum to guide our analysis and our movement forward, that appreciates and recognizes the fundamental common human aspirations of all humanity, especially as it impacts the unique concerns of people of African descent here in the West. That's what sort of led to my eventual, sort of organizational affiliations at the time. I try not to maintain a very parochial or limited way of thinking. Unique and blessed opportunities to have professionally been involved in academia that has been primarily a very urban-based, a very cosmopolitan-based a kind of environment where I typically, even though I've taught in many other university systems, where there hasn't always been a predominant engagement or enrollment of students of African descent, I sort of made a career choice to stay committed and to work within a university systems that predominantly served peoples of African and minority background. And that's what kept me here in Chicago at East West University, Chicago State University, even though I've taught at other universities as well, at Rutgers University and State University of New York, at Bradley University as well. So that's my little personal kind of rationale or context. And I think I'll sort of just stop there. I don't know if I've specifically addressed your immediate questions, but that was the kind of context. So some of the readings of Sashifo Kwame Nkrumah, Drills K. Nereri, Dr. Williams here, the black sort of the Black Power movement that took place here in the United States. There were a lot of critical thinkers, some of the movements that took place in terms of the Black Power movements that took place in the foundational one in Newark, New Jersey. There were a lot of contemporaneous developments of Black Studies programs, one of which still exists today that I'm blessed and fortunate to have contributed to, and that is the establishment of the first actual degree-granting program in African-American studies and Africana studies at the State University of New York at Albany, which exists to the present day. That was my first teaching position, as a matter of fact, my first faculty appointment subsequent to my days of student activism on campus. I never view that as a kind of payoff, so to speak, but it logically led, while I was a doctoral student there, it led to my being offered a position to teach as in that department once it had its inaugural degree granting authority from the state system.
Mm-hmm.
So
Dr. Furi, tell us how and when did you get involved with ICRAM?
Well, ICRAM, as you probably know, was formed back in the late 19 and oh my goodness, over 20 some odd years ago. It's basically a not-for-profit international, by the very definition of being, and I don't know how much your audience would be familiar with what a non-governmental organization is and how those of which there are thousands throughout the world, we have the unique status of being considered of consultative status with ECOSOC, which is the Economic and Social Council of the United Nations. It is within that division. There are six major organizational divisions within the UN operations. I guess the most well-noted one would be the UN Security Council. But to tell the truth, the division of the UN operations that is probably the most dynamic and actually engages the most day-to-day activity is the Economic and Social Council, because it is in that context that most of the implementation of the various resolutions, the directives, the annual meetings that take place at the General Assembly level, where they will review the various intergovernmental policies and directives and resolutions and treaties that have been agreed upon, that's where the rubber meets the road. It is within the context of the Economic and Social Council that the implementation of actual resolutions and programs are carried out. And within that framework, within ECOSOC, the UN High Commission on Human Rights, the Council, is housed within that framework. And ECOSOC is sort of the umbrella through which and by which various sectors from civil society, and the reason it's called non-governmental in nature is because these organizations that are allowed to have status with the United Nations have to not be aligned with any one particular government. Obviously, in terms of their charter, their corporate status, et cetera, they have to be formally recognized and chartered within a particular state, within a particular country somewhere, you know, within the international system where they have legal jurisdiction and so forth. But in point of their operations, in terms of their objectives, in terms of their board membership, in terms of the issues that they address, they have to not be parochial in nature. In other words, their goals and objectives cannot be restricted to just the concerns of a particular nation or particular government, but rather have to be transformative and international in nature. So that's why our organization, which is concerned uniquely about the concerns of peoples of African descent here in the United States, but obviously we're equally concerned about the plight of and the history that has resulted from the enslaved trade and the African diaspora. So we are also particularly concerned about the hemispheric and the international elements in terms of the consolidation, the collective efforts, in a way that is very, very similar to and an extension of what we just quickly addressed before, as was the movements of the African Liberation Movement, where the heads of state saw a similar kind of concern to address some of their common needs and aspirations. ICRAM is envisioned as an organization that within a human rights framework, subsequent to the Charter of the United Nations back in 1945, one of the first universally agreed upon charters or covenants that the 50-some-odd nations at that time, because by that in the early 50s, mid-50s, most of what we now know as African and Asian and South American nations, they had not gained any independence. Ghana, as we just mentioned, in the 50s was the very first one out of the entire continent of Africa that had any formally declared independence and became a recognized sovereign state. So as a result of that transformation, we began to see the proliferation of an increasing movement toward decolonization, and it's within the context of another organization called the Trusteeship Council within the United Nations. You might recall that Ambassador Bunch, who was an African-American, who was entrusted with the responsibility to help serve as a conduit as for the United Nations, for being the Secretariat of the Trusteeship Council, he helped facilitate and move many of the African and Latin American and Asian nations that were clamoring for independence at the time to avoid a proliferation of confrontational liberation movements, et cetera, so that this normal transformation could take place between the colonizing nations of the North, predominantly in Europe, and reconciling and trying to find a smoother path toward collaboration and liberation and sovereignty for many of those developing nations at the time. And the Trusteeship Council, under the leadership of Ambassador Bunch at the time, has played a very, very historical role. I think that the impact and the role that he played in collaboration with the United Nations is probably not as well spoken to or addressed in the way it properly should be. So it was within that context that Dr. Yusuf Naeem Khly, who has his own, has a very, very interesting, I invite your audience to sort of Google the brother, Dr. Khly, Yusuf Naeem Khly, spelled K-L-Y, who was from the Gullah Geechee community in the Carolinas, in South Carolina, who at the time that he made his sojourn was back in the late 30s and 40s and 50s. And in order to complete his graduate training, even though he was allowed because he had won a scholarship, but the South Carolina was still segregated at the time, and they wouldn't even allow him to go into the field of study, which was international law and political science. They didn't at the time see that it was possible for a brother such as he to be allowed to attend, take advantage of, the scholarship and the academic development that he aspired to. So to make a long story short, he eventually had to leave the country and complete his doctoral studies in Canada, and then lived and spent time in Africa, et cetera. And as a result of his doctoral thesis, as a result of his studies abroad, he probably, and I don't want to over-exaggerate the importance of the contribution that this brother almost single-handedly made, he began to come up with he published a book called The Social Contract, which he addressed the unique needs of people of African descent within the international human rights context. It was in the 1996, to be precise, that the United Nations began to form and craft what is called the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, which served as the framework for the various nations who had now gained their independence, who were now aspirational or trying to create their own infrastructure, their own social systems, their own to become part of a larger world community. But they were probably not even 10 or 15 years, old as far as being independent nations were concerned. And so you had this unique problem where heretofore, up until that time, most of the affairs of the United Nations was almost governed by a unipolar system where
that is the adhan being called, and I will say that it's the adhan is always right on time. But we will not hinder our beloved brother from making his sojourn to Juma on this blessed day. Some people have already started fasting, I would believe. But brother, I would have to stop you there just to ensure my responsibility to you in terms of having a half hour discussion, but say this is just part one, and we'll continue that inshallah. And please hold that point. Right in the mid sentence.
if we needed, I mean, it's your call, brother. But I would have maybe a good 10 to 15 minutes to do what needs to be done and move on. But whatever's your pleasure. Suffice it to say that sort of the turning point, as far as international human rights is concerned, and the framing of an international system where at least the concerns of peoples of African descent and other minority status eventually became recognized and crafted within a legally and internationally reasonable framework that various nations and communities that signed on to and agreed to those particular criteria could then begin to create some movement. Unfortunately, the United States it took them over 30 years to eventually ratify that particular seminal and foundational covenant, which maybe we can talk about in the subsequent discussion. But that particular international convention, along with several others, was first crafted and recognized in 1966. It didn't become internationally ratified until 1977, and the United States did not become a signatory to that binding agreement until 1992. So here we are. There are many other subsequent provisions and declarations that have particular relevance to peoples of African descent here in the United States that, according to our research and surveys, over 85% of the American citizenry has absolutely no knowledge of. That is not to say that American leadership isn't quite familiar with this, but for whatever reason, there hasn't been the collective and very focused and deliberate educative exposure to the options that are available to us as a people here in the United States and elsewhere throughout the Americas that can be taken full advantage, strategic advantage of, to see what systems are in place and what options we have within the framework of both international and domestic law, where we can righteously come together and collectively address many of our day-to-day problems and concerns. And so there's some things afoot at the present time, which time doesn't permit us to go into. Perhaps in a subsequent conversation, we can address that. But one important aspect of this has to do with our historically black colleges and universities, of which there are over 100 here in the United States, as well as the predominantly black institutions of higher education, where there are close to another 100 institutions that basically service the needs of peoples of African descent and many other ethnic minority groups here throughout the United States that are already well established, that are already formally recognized by the Congress of the United States, and legislatively are entitled to certain considerations that are unique to help us address the concerns that obviously have to be well addressed. And we feel that this is a logical incubator. It's a logical laboratory through which we can, in a very self-reliant and self-determined way, which we are afforded the option of doing that within the framework of both conventional civil rights and domestic law, never mind to say the international prerogatives that we have that are assured by international law, where we should be able to more forthrightly address some of those issues collectively for ourselves and enter into formal collaboration with the State Department and other entities at the federal and state level, where we can harmonize we can reconcile what has already been agreed to by the United States in terms of its international treaty obligations, as well as in terms of its own self-righteously declared rights of justice and equality for its own citizenry here in the United States, of which we obviously are one of the most historically senior-ranking tenants and citizens, even though we have always been labeled with minority status.
Excellent. Next, I'd like to introduce to the audience, not for the first time, but maybe to each other, Dr. M. Fantabantu Iverson, who earned his doctorate from the Department of Political Science at Clark Atlanta University in 2007. His dissertation, Serving in the Shadows, African-American Women Healthcare Workers in Gary, Indiana, 1980 to 2000, is an examination of workplace and union conditions and resistance strategies of African-American women. His area of scholarly interests are feminist theory, African-American political thought, labor studies, and human rights. Professor Iverson has been a faculty member in the labor studies since 1996. So this extra 10 minutes that you afforded us, Dr. Muhammad, has given me the ability to introduce you two to one another. Dr. Fantabantu, are you there?
Yes, brother. Thank you so much. And I'm very delighted to meet my brother and fellow activists.
Oh, my brother, my apologies, brother. I did not know the exact format and agenda. I wouldn't have run my mouth as extensively as perhaps I did to afford.
No, brother, no. No apology. No apology is needed, brother. What you have shared is absolutely essential for our people to begin to digest. And there is, I am particularly grateful to you, and I want to say this, at this time, I'm especially grateful to the protracted struggle that you and others have been engaged in for so long to try to work within the existing United Nations Human Rights Framework fully knowledgeable that that framework has a number of contradictions, particularly with respect to peoples of color and women, LGBTQI people around the world, the framework that we have that you're working within is very difficult. And the work you're doing is behind the scenes for many of us. And I just want to thank you for keeping your eye on the prize of liberation.
Well, thank you, brother. And hopefully this is the conversation that can be continued going forward. Brother Najee is very adept at facilitating such things. So we'll look forward to him hopefully doing that.
Absolutely.
Dr. Muhammad, I would say that, stay on as long as you can, but again, I want to respect.
Yes, I'm going to excuse myself if you don't mind, brother.
Understandable. That was the agreement. And what you laid out is truly foundational and certainly a bridge that Dr. Batu can continue on. The bridge you laid out was excellent. It's wide enough, it's sturdy enough, and now he's going to just walk right across it. So, Brother Muhammad, thank you so very much.
thank you. Thank you so much.
Of a thousand parts.
Thank you, brother.
You brothers
thank
have
you,
a blessed and safe holiday, okay? Take care now.
Thank you, brother. You too.
Enjoy
as well.
Bye-bye.
My brother, Dr. Batu.
Yes, brother.
So I'm delighted and honored that you carved out your time. And I will say to the listening audience, it was like impromptu. We had talked about a show and guests and getting guests on and so forth and so on. And when I called him this morning to say, brother, could you be on the show? He said, let me see what I can do. And he moved things, his agenda around to accommodate that. So I want to acknowledge you for that. For your generosity in that way. So the three questions, I asked the former guest, and now we'll ask you, are one, being that this is, the name of the show is 1 week after and 1 day after. And of course, I'm referring to 1 week after the May 19th, being the birth date of El-Hajj Balik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, Omawali, and 1 day after being the day after African Liberation Day that's been celebrated since about 1959. And then three, what are you doing to continue those movements that you've been, what has been your involvement with Malcolm X and his thinking and his work? What has been your involvement with African Liberation Day? And then thirdly, how was that translated into how you're living your life right now?
Well, that's a lot to try to do within a short period of time. I'll try to be succinct and lay the basis, hopefully, for continuing conversations with you and with the brother who just jumped off the show.
Dr. Muhammad.
First of all, Dr. Muhammad, yes. Thank you so much, Brother Najee, for your generous introduction. Let me begin by saying that let me go back to the time of Malcolm X's assassination, because that was the first time I heard my family members in Columbus, Ohio, talk about Malcolm X. And unfortunately, I think there was a lot about which they were unclear. And in fact, perhaps even they might have been somewhat hostile. I remember when Malcolm X was killed, my godfather, who was an African-American minister in the African Methodist Episcopal Church, made the comment that, if you live by violence, you die by violence. That was his assessment. It was, I believe, and I think further examination of Malcolm X's life and the struggle in which he was engaged will attest to the fact that my godfather was absolutely wrong. He was incorrect. But he had, I think, been influenced, as had I and other people in the national black community, had been influenced by the predominant narratives of the press and the most reactionary and even liberal politicians of that time. Malcolm X was cast as an apostle of violence, when in fact he was an advocate, a freedom fighter, who called for the liberation of African people in the United States and around the world. And while he did talk about self-determination, he also talked about self-defense. And so, you know, when we really stopped to think about it, there was a lot that my godfather did not understand. I began with that, Onaji, because my next introduction to Malcolm X came at Hiram College in 1967. And at that time, we had a writer in residence at Hiram. His name was Henry Dumas. And Henry is no longer with us. He was murdered in 1968 by a traffic policeman in New York, a subway policeman in New York City. But people can read about Henry Dumas. He was a brilliant writer. He was a contemporary of Amiri Baraka and a number of other folks. He was perhaps one of the unsung voices of the black struggle to bring about the understanding of black literature and black poetry and the like. Henry was a poet in residence at Hiram College, and he had sort of drawn a number of us black students together. And we would from time to time, you know, get together in Henry's apartment on campus and listen to different records. And one of the records that we listened to on this particular day was The Ballot or the Bullet, the speech by Malcolm X. And I was, it was one of the most profound experiences that I had had up until that point of my life. I was riveted by what he had to say, by the way in which he challenged not only the U.S. government for its capitalist and racist and imperialist imperatives, but he also called out a number of African American so-called leaders, and this was one of the first times that I had ever heard his voice, and I was absolutely riveted. I was also, to be quite frank, scared to death. Malcolm scared me out of my Negro-ness, if you will. He made me take a look at he began for me. He helped me to begin, I should say, a journey examining not only my own thinking, but the thinking and the feelings of many people around me. And he actually helped to fuel a radicalization of my spirit, my mind, and thus my behaviors began to change. But that's another story for another time. I will simply say that Malcolm X really helped to set some standards for independent thinking. He helped me to begin to rethink what it means to call oneself a human being. He helped me to begin to ask some very serious questions, not only about this or that political party in the United States or this or that political leader, but in fact, he helped me to begin to question the foundations of the United States as a nation itself. He helped me to begin to think about all of the liberal platitudes and the liberal ideas that are so often held up as standards for the rest of the world, when in fact they are dripping with the blood
of our people and peoples of the world, who some who live here and many who live outside the boundaries of this country. And Malcolm X was one of the first to really capture my attention begin to move me, help me to move forward. And when I began to look at Malcolm, and then I began to look more deeply into Martin, I realized over time the ways in which these two righteous brothers had been pitted against one another, so that we tended at that time, and unfortunately some may even now still tend to think that Malcolm was militant and Dr. King was somehow passive. And I think that that's something that we need to try to diligently correct, because when we look at these two men, both of them were murdered for very similar reasons. And when we start to look at what they were each espousing and what they were each trying to do in terms of social movement building at the times of their murders, their assassinations, we see that each of them was focused on human rights. Each of them was a very deeply spiritual man. And each of them were trying to build social movement from the bottom up, not from the top down. And what I mean by that is they were both very people-centered in what they were trying to do. They were trying to build social movements where the voices and the visions and the experiences of the masses of our people would be lifted up and would become the lens through which we looked at all that we were trying to do for our liberation and the liberation of other people, and ultimately the liberation of Mother Earth. And so that was my introduction to Malcolm X, and I tried to read as much as I could about him after that. Let me quickly come. I know your time is moving on.
No. It's not my time. I have open time. I want to be considerate of your time, since this was somewhat of an impromptu invitation. But don't think that the restriction of time is on my end. It's not.
Actually, okay. Well,
know that you have the space to continue in what you're sharing with us and answering those questions, please.
All right. Well, thank you for that. Let me then go to my introduction to African Liberation Day and African liberation support work here in the United States. I need to back up a little bit and point out that I was fortunate in October of 1971 to go to East Africa, Tanzania in particular, although I was also able to spend very limited time in Uganda and also in Kenya. But I spent 10 months within Tanzania, living within I was actually based for most of that time in a little area outside of Dar es Salaam called Kurasini. And Kurasini had for some time prior to the announcement by the Tanzanian African Union and Julius Nyerere, that Tanzania was moving directly toward Ujamaa socialism. Prior to that time, Kurasini had been sort of an enclave for Germans who had come from Germany and were, making their lives anew in Tanzania. But when many of these people found out that Tanzania was heading in the direction of a kind of Ujamaa socialism, they wanted to get out. They wanted no parts of socialism. In much the same way, I would suggest that we've seen so many Cubans leave after the founding of the Cuban Revolution. But that's another conversation. Anyway, in 1971, I was fortunate enough to go to Tanzania. And by 1972, I had come back to the United States after having had an opportunity to meet a number of African Americans who had that I had met there, And I got a chance to talk and learn from a number of representatives of liberation organizations from Southern Africa. Tanzania, Dar es Salaam, actually, for a while was a place where Julius Nyerere and the Tanzanian African Union made available to representatives of liberation forces so that they could come there and continue their work when they could not actually continue the work in the same way in the countries that for which they were fighting for liberation. But the point I'm trying to make here is that as a result of my understanding of Malcolm, I began in the late 60s and very early 70s to develop an increasingly sharp anti-imperialist consciousness. It was out of that anti-imperialist consciousness and a desire to understand what socialism would be like in Africa. I wanted to see for myself, and so I saved money living in Cleveland, Ohio at the time, and was able to, I was blessed to be able to save enough, and I was able to go and spend 10 months in East Africa. I came back to the United States fired up even more with my anti-imperialist consciousness. And actually, I was beginning to think much more in terms of the importance of learning about socialism and recognizing that wherever capitalism has been, there has been misery that it has created. And so I came back to the United States fully committed to trying to find my way to be more active in political and organizing work. And in 1973, I found my way to Nashville, Tennessee, working at Meharry Community Mental Health Center. But while I was there, I actually became more and more aware of African liberation support work. At that time, there was African liberation support work going on in a number of different places, and in fact, this work was designed to further promote the liberation struggles, particularly in Angola, Mozambique, and Guinea-Bissau against the Portuguese. And at that time, the Gulf Oil Company was one of the major contributors, one of the major supporters of those colonizers. And of course, the United States had no small hand in all of that double dealing and misery creation, not only here in the United States, but in Africa. So when I got to Nashville, I became aware of African Liberation Support Committee, and there's a direct line then between my understanding of Malcolm going to Africa and then coming back and becoming immersed in the African liberation support work. And interestingly enough, as I began to get more involved in African liberation support work, it not only helped me to think more in terms of what we could do in this country to support the struggles of our brothers and sisters in Africa, but it also helped me to sharpen my consciousness and radicalize my understanding and my behavior with respect to what we could do here in the United States and how we would have to move. I had had a conversation when I was in Dar es Salaam with some folks from Frelimo, the Liberation Front for Mozambique. And, you know, there were a number of us who had considered, well, maybe we should just, you know, try to join Frelimo here in Southern Africa and get involved in this way and fight the Portuguese directly. And, of course, you know, I was in my 20s. You know, when we're in those years, very often we're perhaps naive about some of the things that we're thinking about doing, but my heart was in the right place, and so with others we went to Frelimo and talked with them about what might be the possibilities of working with them in support of liberation struggle in that area. But then they made a case that we should come back to the United States. They told us, brothers, we thank you for coming. We thank you for your interest. But to tell you the truth, it would be all, you know, we would love to have you just go back to Cleveland, go back to Atlanta, go back to Chicago, go back to New York, go back to the cities of the United States and do work there. Because you will then be in the belly of the beast. That was basically how they viewed the United States. And it made a lot of sense. And so, you know, I came back with that in mind and went to Nashville with that in mind. And so it was in Nashville that I became more actively involved in African Liberation Support work of the African Liberation Support Committee. Among the things that we were doing, there was a boycott on Gulf oil at the time that we participated in. We did quite a bit of education, around the South. And one of the things that happened out of that work on Najee was that more and more brothers and sisters began to think in terms of socialism and how to struggle for socialism. Here in the United States, based on the lived experiences of our people. This was not just, there were a number of problems in the 1970s, as we know, and we have to be very careful not to reproduce those problems. You know, a lot of sectarian views about this organization or that organization, a lot of infighting, which was counterproductive ultimately. But I think that many of us had our hearts, if not our minds, in the right places. And we were beginning to think about how some of the lessons that had begun to emerge with the work of SNCC could be further developed. There was a lot of political work that had gone on and was denounced during the McCarthy period that we were trying to reconnect to. And so the idea of fighting for a transformed United States was very much alive amongst us, and that was largely because of the very rich and vibrant work that was going on within African Liberation Support Committees around the United States. At that time, we could go on and talk about that at another point, Onaji, but I want to try to come to what we're trying to do now. And I'll simply say, without trying to give my whole life in a few moments, I would simply say that.
Brother, before you do that, I need to ask you a few questions here.
Sure, go ahead.
I have. Had the phenomenal blessing to meet some of the greatest African Pan-Africanists in the world, and I'm giving reference to first I'll say Neville Parker. I don't know if you knew him when you were in Tanzania, but if you
did not. I did not know him then, but I have since learned of him.
Okay, so for the listening audience, just to give you some idea of who this man was, I would say it like this. Dr. Parker is to Pan-Africanism and technology as Kwame Ture is to Pan-Africanism in political struggle.
Wow.
Both of them are sons of Trinidad. Mm-hmm. Both of them have lived their adult lives in United States and very much involved with student movements. Both of them became Pan-Africanists and moved and lived in Africa. Brother Parker delivered the six-pack science and technology presentation from all of the members that created the document, but he was the spokesman. And it was there that President Julius Nyerere had challenged him on the question, was this rhetoric or was this actual? And that led to him being invited to teach at the University of Dar al-Islam and to, in fact, create their first national policy on transportation. He's a civil engineer. He returned to America, City College in particular, and under the condition that he would be able to bring aspiring engineers from Africa to City College on an annual basis, and that they would then, therefore, he became the progenitor of engineers throughout the African continent. And even when he did consult to the African nations, all of the money that he made there stayed there in Africa. The man is sorely unrecognized and unknown, particularly by Pan-Africans throughout the world. But as I said earlier, he is to Pan-Africanism in the technical line, engineering line, as Kwame Ture is in the political line. So he was probably there at the same time that you were there in Tanzania. And I didn't know if you knew him at all, but I wanted to certainly bring him into the conversation in that you shared with us your experience in Tanzania. And of course, if we're speaking of African Liberation Day, we cannot have this conversation without bringing in Kwame Ture, who, as the General Secretary of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, had a lot to do with popularizing African Liberation Day here in the United States, notwithstanding that it was actually Irwin Davis, the founder of the Pan-African Skills Project, and as well as the co-director of the Patrice Lumumba Coalition, who actually held the first African Liberation Day in D.C. prior to Kwame Ture, a history, a historical fact that unfortunately not too people know as well. So I could not have this conversation on Malcolm X and African Liberation Day without bringing into this conversation and lifting up our ancestors, Kwame Ture, and certainly bring into the conversation Dr. Neville Parker, who is still with us. He's retired from City College now, but we certainly, I need to have him on the show as well. So thank you for letting me intercede in that, but I didn't want to leave the continent of Africa and particularly leave Tanzania without bringing into the conversation Dr.
Yes, certainly. Certainly, I understand. And so, that's to the question of what we're trying to do right now, living here in Denver, Colorado. Let me back up just a little bit, Onaje, about 7-8 years ago, when I was fortunate enough to be one of the founding members of the U.S. Human Rights Network. That organization's first director was a well-known and much-respected revolutionary brother, Ajamu Baraka. And he was actually the brother who introduced the idea of a U.S. Human Rights Network to me and a number of other folk coming out of a couple of conferences in which Black women and women of color had come together, first in California and then at Howard University, to rethink the question of human rights and to look specifically at the lived experiences of Black people, particularly in that moment, Black women, to try to understand how human rights could be applied in that period. And we're talking now about the 1990s. And so subsequent to those meetings, in California and in D.C., The U.S. Human Rights Network was born in an organizational sense, and today it is a network of at least 300 organizations around the country. And the whole idea of the U.S. Human Rights Network is to engage various peoples in the struggle to build people-centered human rights movement to address not only the civil and political rights of people, but to also address the economic, social, and cultural rights, which, as you know very well, are some of the rights that have been most denied as we have seen the onset of the neoliberal corporate agenda from the 1970s until now. So I was fortunate to get involved with the U.S. Human Rights Network and to help build it as a board member. And while I was doing that, I also had the great opportunity to go in, I'm trying to get these, in 2008, yeah. 2008, we took a delegation of right around 300 people, I believe it was, 150 to 200 people. I have forgotten some of the numbers, but we took a large delegation to Geneva in order to participate in the country review, what is called a country review of the U.S. government. Brother Muhammad, Dr. Muhammad, had originally said during his remarks, he made reference to some of the procedures that take place within the United Nations human rights system. And one of these is the country review that takes place when countries have ratified particular international conventions or treaties. As Dr. Muhammad noted, it was around 1992 and 1994 when the U.S. government had finally ratified the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the CERD, or sometimes called ICERD, and more popularly referred to, as you have referred to it, and as we referred to it last week on the radio show, the Race Treaty. Because the United States is a has ratified and is a signatory to this convention now, there are certain obligations that the United States has. And periodically, I believe it's every 4 to 6 years, something like that, the U.S. has to report before the world on its efforts to end racism in the United States, its compliance and its non-compliance with the CERD treaty elements, and so the provisions of the CERD treaty. So in 2008, we had an amazing delegation that went to Geneva, and folk who had come from across the United States, and it was a very diverse grouping of folks. Folks talked about lived experiences of structural racism that they had been dealing with here in the United States, not in China, you know, not in the Soviet Union, but talking about the ways in which structural racism continues to distort and destroy black lives, brown lives, even white lives in the United States. And it was an amazing experience, as you can imagine, Anaja, and I know you've traveled internationally. This is one of those moments that I never expected to experience, to actually leave the United States, where our voices and our experiences of structural racism are often denied and dismissed and turned upside down, and to go to Geneva, Switzerland, and to be in a room filled with people whose languages and cultures I did not yet I appreciated but did not appreciate fully because I could not speak the languages of many of the experts who sit on the international committee that scrutinizes the United States and other countries that are partners to this international CERD treaty. We sat in a room, in a hall, and we listened to both. We listened to oral testimony being presented, and we also had compiled what are called shadow reports, which are the opportunities for documenting at the grassroots level in civic society the violations of human rights as a result of the oppression that people experience here in the United States. The committee had both written testimony and oral testimony on Najee, and when it came time for the experts to comment, one of the most riveting questions that resounded across that hall was when one of the experts asked the State Department representative, why is it that you all in the United States seem to have a different understanding of racism and human rights than so many of us around the world? And you could have heard a pin drop. People were in tears. I was in tears because I had never expected to have the experiences of my four mothers and forefathers validated in an international setting such as this, when in fact they were always dismissed here in the United States. They were always distorted. They all were always lied about here in the United States. But to go to Geneva and have people who I'd never met hear the stories of people's lived experiences of structural racism, of being brutalized in prisons. We had transgendered women. We had gay men. We had people talking about their experiences connected with the structural racism that is systemically grounded here in the United States. And to have people talk about all of these different experiences was an amazing, amazing experience. And so we continue to try to work on human rights today here in Denver, Colorado. I'm active around issues of fighting for housing rights. We're actively fighting around workers' rights. And there are just a couple things I would like to offer on Najee, so that folk who are our listeners will be clearer about what we're meaning when we talk about human rights. And I won't take very long. One of the things that I think is very important as we are advancing the work around in this race treaty program, I mean, we have said to one another that we're not just here to educate, but our education is designed to lead to some organizing of our people across the United States. But one of the challenges I think that we run into, Najee, is that when we talk with Black people around human rights, Dr. Muhammad referenced how much our people still have been denied in terms of our knowledge of human rights, because you're not going to hear about the human rights violations facing Black people by listening to CNN. Or for that matter, if you listen to MSNBC, you're not going to hear that much about it either. You really have to begin to get involved in our communities. We have to get involved in organizations. We have to study. We have to read. We have to try to travel to find out what, in fact, people are doing to deal with the myriad of human rights violations that we are suffering as a result of this corporate agenda that's designed to make the greatest amount of profit possible for corporations and to rob working people of any opportunity to defend ourselves against the many, many violations that we're experiencing. We are now trying to help people understand, not just to educate, but to organize ourselves. And so it's very important to deal with the challenge that we confront, or we have to confront, when our people ask us, well, what do you mean by human rights? Many of our people think that human rights resides in New York City at the UN. Many of our people don't necessarily appreciate the significance of a human rights conversation because we hear people talking about what's going on in China. We hear people talking about human rights violations in Russia. Human rights violations are also often viewed as something that takes place outside the United States. But in fact, the killing of Trayvon Martin, when we look at it and we begin to dissect it, we see that this was a human rights violation. The furor that developed around the murder of Brother Mike Brown, the sister Sandra Bland, these are examples of human rights violations that have taken place in the United States. And we might also point out that it happened under, you know, Mike Brown, and Sandra Bland happened on the watch of the first black president of the United States. So we have to look very deeply at what we mean by human rights and human rights violations. And one of the things I think we have to say to our people, Onazi, is that we're not talking simply about documents. We're not just talking about procedures. Human rights are something that every one of us as human beings is it's the basic minimum that any human being should have. It's a standard below which no human being should have to fall. And by virtue of being born, as my mom used to say, as by virtue of being a child of God, we have certain human rights, and everybody in the world should have them. But here's the point. Unless we recognize that human rights are born of struggle, we cannot defend them, because they are born of struggle. And as they say, we had a pamphlet that was created at the U.S. Human Rights Network entitled Born of Struggle, Implemented Through Struggle. Human rights have to be realized through the struggle of people who are being violated. And just simply knowing what documents say our rights are is not enough. We have to also look at our lived experiences and point to those many, many, many times when black people in the United States have fought for rights. They've been called civil rights many times when in fact they were human rights, not just the right to vote, but the right to also have an adequate standard of living. So I just think that this is one of the challenges that we are going to have to confront again and again and again as we try to drill down and make sense of this, the moral and spiritual and political imperatives of fighting for human rights.
Thank you, brother. As Malcolm used to say, make it plain.
Naji, just let me, if I may just say one other thing,
and sure.
Then I will have to bounce, because I got to go pick up my grandkids. That's their human right. I got to go take care of that. When we were in the U.S. Human Rights Network, we lifted up, and I'm still a member of the U.S. Human Rights Network, but I'm trying to continue to lift up something that we learned from Ella Baker. Ella Baker used to talk about the importance of being people-centered. She used to say that strong people do not need strong leaders. And she was very critical of much of the practice of the so-called civil rights organizations. And at times she was even critical of SCLC because there was such emphasis on building social movement with the idea of the great leader. Movements were being built with the idea that we should be trying to defend some talented tents, which in fact Dr. Du Bois, even though he did put forward this notion, this theory of this ideal of the talented tenth in the 1920s, by the time he got to the 1950s, his own lived experiences had shown him that he could often not count on those who were most well off amongst the black population in the United States, the so-called talented tenth. And so he basically moved away from and repudiated that idea of the talented tenth. When he gave a speech at the Boulé, I believe it was in 1958 or 59, at Wilberforce, Ohio. And he basically said to people, listen, I put this idea out here, but we need to get away from this idea, because what I have learned is that it is going to be from the masses of our people, the working people of our black population, that we have to really rely on if we're going to pursue liberation, because all too often folks who have it better than the vast majority of other black people tend to end up siding with the system, tend to go on to reproduce the very kinds of oppressions that we have been fighting against. And so we need to have what Ella Baker defined as a people-centered approach to building up a struggle for human rights. And that means that we cannot rely on those individuals. And I'm not disparaging any of us who get PhDs or who have had the benefit of academic training. Kwame Nkrumah had such training. Julius Nyerere had such training. Ella Baker had that kind of training. Alma Carker Brau had that kind of training. It's not so much that we're not disparaging training and education. What we're disparaging is betrayal of one's people in order to benefit one's own personal agenda. We're saying that we need to have people-centered human rights struggle so that we won't get caught up trying to defend the struggle of a small minority of people and ignoring the experiences of the vast majority. We have a serious problem in the United States at this point, Onaji, not only because the human rights agenda, which was put forward initially in the post-World War II period and which grew into the UN system, that was a system that initially, even when it had been established, it was denying the continued colonization of people in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Women, the experiences of women worldwide, and certainly in the United States, were not a part of that vision. We're not in the forefront of that vision. And many other people were denied and marginalized in that vision. That's one problem we have to deal with, even today, as we deal with the human rights notions that many people have. Many people think in terms of human rights, but it's a very liberal kind of orientation that we cannot afford to reproduce amongst oppressed peoples. We have got to see that this all of the work that's being done by well-intentioned people who are very liberal, very pro-Democrat, in many, many instances, as you know, Onaji, the lived experiences of the people most affected by human rights violations still are being marginalized. We see this also in the work of what some people have come to call the nonprofit industrial complex, where you have this, since the 1980s, we have seen an enormous proliferation of organizations that are supposedly about social justice. And there are people who make their paychecks every week fighting for social justice through these organizations. Now, let me be clear, I'm not disparaging fighting for social justice, but when you have people who are using the money of philanthropy, when you have people who are using the money that comes from the exploitation of peoples around the United States and the world, and then using some of that money to give back, supposedly, quote unquote, give back to organizations so that they can do social reform, very often what happens in these organizations, and there are many, many organizations like this now, very often what happens is that the funding imperatives, the requirements that you have to satisfy in order to get funded in this or that cycle, you end up losing sight of the struggle that we're involved in to fight for the human rights of people, and we end up having to satisfy the dictates, the mandates, the requirements of the funders. And what this basically says is that we have to learn how to build struggles amongst the people who are most affected, with the leadership of those brothers and sisters who are the most affected, guiding our work for human rights. This is going to be one of our major challenges. And colleagues who probably would not be happy to know that we're having this kind of conversation over the airwaves, but I think a lot of people are beginning to understand that these are some of the limitations that we run into. It's not to say that people who work in nonprofit organizations are bad. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that those organizations, when they have the funding of people who have benefited directly and or indirectly from the exploitation and oppression of the vast majority of people, that's where their money comes from. And so when you have that money coming back around the corner in the form of social justice efforts and social reform organizations, we have to be very careful. You take that money, you end up eventually sometimes having to follow the dictates of funders and not the needs and visions of the people that you began to try to serve in the first place. So these are some of the challenges, I think, that we have to address as we continue to try to build people-centered human rights organizations that are grassroots, that deal with all kinds of oppression. We have to have social justice, human rights organizations, and movements that are anti-racist, that are anti-patriarchal, that is to say they are opposed to the systems of sexism and patriarchy. We have to be anti-capitalist. We have to be anti-imperialist, because if we're not, we will end up reproducing the very kinds of oppressions that has created the human rights violations that we're fighting with our brothers and sisters in these urban and rural areas across this country, indeed across the world.
Wow, that is instructive. In terms of as we move forward, letting us know the things to look at, evaluate, and move in such a fashion that the common person, that is the person on the street who doesn't have the PhD, who doesn't have that master's degree, that doesn't have that bachelor's degree, nor associates, and maybe not even a high school diploma, the majority, the masses of our people have to always be put first. And putting them first is knowing that our role is to always develop leadership, as Ella Baker has so profoundly said. I didn't come here to build an organization. I came here to build a movement. And that movement has continued. And it's been this spirit, as well as the work of you, Dr. Thantabantu, work of Dr. Muhammad, and all of your colleagues and all of the movements and all of the associations and social formations that you've come through, that has kept this particular mission alive. And I'm so happy to have met you and to have worked and to be working with you. And I did not know that you were a co-founder of the United States Human Rights Network. That is so good for me to know and for the audience to know. And it's so good that you are still a part of it, because it keeps the organization honest. Often people will, start an organization and it has a particular trajectory, and other people will come in and other people will go out. And before you know it, the organization finds itself in a whole different strata than its original creation. So you are keeping that focus. You're keeping the organization honest, and that's a wonderful thing. So, brother, I will not delay you in picking up your grands. So thank you so much, Dr. Thantabantu. And this
thank
is
you just for having me. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Thank you for having me, and just know that I look forward to continuing this dialogue, not only with you, but with brothers and sisters around the country. There's so much work for us to do, and I just want to encourage brothers and sisters, even if you haven't known too much about it, even if you haven't thought too much about human rights, just think about, the world that you want for your grandma, the world you want for your mom, your dad, for yourself, your wife, your friend, the partner, your brother, your sister, your niece, your nephew, your next door neighbor. Think about what you want to see and then begin to work for that.
wherever you are. Get in where you can fit in, and let's build a people-centered, a whole range of struggles, depending upon where we are, build some struggles for human rights. Thank you, and I look forward to talking with you later.
Thank you. This is Onaa Jimmy Wade, host of Race Treaty, co-host, that is. And tonight we have looked at the question a week after, a day after, referring to 19.